Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Good afternoon to another soggy, rainy day here on Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Southern Sense. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, and with the most fabulous, the most debonair, the most handsome and coolest of co-hosts, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Wow. Man, each intro, Annie, every single show gets better and better. I am doing great. It's actually a sunny fall day here. And she's doing well, very, very excited about our show. I had to swallow something. Southern Sense is reaching out to you. Reach out and touch someone like the Omaha Bell. Well, come on and touch us back. We are networking everywhere. Annie's working on a website, but we're also on Twitter and on Facebook. Annie's all about that. So come on, be our friend as we join you networking everywhere with Stitcher and Stretch It with the other one. And we're also available on iTunes.
Absolutely.
And today we have a very, very, very special show. And our guest is at a rally and will call us after the rally. Can't get any more politically on top of it than that.
Absolutely. Diane Nagy is touring with the Tea Party Express, and they've got a huge We Built It, Rebuild America tour going on. It's To Fire Obama. So they're going to be coming into a lot of towns. So you can check. We'll have that website up shortly in the chat room. And she'll be talking about that. You know, there's something else going on, too. I found this out. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be sending it over to my pastor. There's a rally going on nationwide Saturday, October 20th. It's called Stand Up, and it's for religious freedom. And I've got the flyer in front of me, and they've got some really cool people that are going to be on this one in Balboa Park in San Diego. I'm going to try to see if... Oh, here it is. The website is standupforreligiousfreedom.com. They're also on Facebook. So it looks like they're trying to get a nationwide religious rally going on just shortly before the election. That's going to be proved to be very, very interesting. So we'll see what happens with that.
This is kind of, this election for many, many reasons is somewhat of a, I guess I don't want to say a last-ditch effort, but it's so almost what appears to be desperation for we the people versus government on so many different aspects, one of them being religion, where Barack Obama is really the first president to challenge places of faith and employment of worship, forcing them to go against what they stand for, basically saying that they have to adhere to government. So this is very, very important as the religious community gets out to basically defend the republic as well as the religious freedoms, which is one of the main reasons this country was founded.
Yeah, actually, I'm reading from this flyer, and they have it. It says, in January 2012, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued a mandate requiring all employer health plans to include free contraceptives, sterilization, and abortion-inducing drugs, regardless of any moral or religious objections. Catholic universities and hospitals will be forced by the federal government to provide services that directly contradict church teaching. The HHS mandate is an unprecedented assault on religious freedom and our First Amendment rights and must be opposed. They say, come stand in defense of your church. Actually, it's not just the Catholic churches. It's you know, Episcopalian, it's Baptist. So, like I said, I'm sending this on to my pastor and seeing if they're going to be willing to do something about that. So before we bring our guest on, we want to do our dedication. And those who listen know that every single show we start off with a dedication to a fallen military hero. We can never, ever say thank you enough or repay the debt that we owe these men and women. And today's dedication is to Chief Warrant Officer Second Class Thalia S. Ramirez. And I've also included Jose L. Montenegro Jr., who died with her. So we're going to go forward with our dedication now.
Okay.
We need to lower that. There we go. A San Antonio was one of two U.S. Army soldiers killed in a helicopter crash on September 9 this year in Afghanistan. Chief Warrant Officer 2nd Class Thalia S. Ramirez, 28, of San Antonio, and Jose L. Montenegro Jr., 31, of San Juan in Rio Grande Valley, died while flying their helicopter, an OH-58D Kiowa Warrior. The aircraft carries a two-person crew, including, according to the military website. I'm sorry, my teeth are in backwards today. The crash occurred in Afghanistan's Logar province. According to published reports, there are indications that the helicopter was shot down. But the Department of Defense news release states the cause of the crash remains under investigation. Ramirez and Montenegro were part of the 1st Squadron, 17th Cavalry Regiment, 82nd Combat Aviation Brigade, and 82nd Airborne Division, based in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Both soldiers had nearly completed a year-long deployment, according to the Department of Defense. Originally of Nairobi, Kenya, Ramirez joined the Army in 2003 as a water purification specialist. She became a pilot in 2008. As on her second deployment, according to news release, Ramirez had flown more than 270 missions and 650 hours during her latest tour of duty. Ramirez had recently escaped an insurgent attack, said Chief Warrant Officer Joseph Panza. In June, I was in engagement with Thalia, where our aircraft were being engaged by insurgents with machine guns in multiple locations, Panza said in a news release. Both aircraft took battle damage, but we continued the flight. We took out all the insurgents we could, then continued and contained the enemy with our M4 until we had control over the fight. That is the kind of warrior Thalia was. She leaves behind her husband, Jesse Belbeck, in the United States, and her mother and father, Justin Ramirez, and Alexandria Mole in Kenya. Montenegro was known as Monty to friends, was originally from Houston, and his mother and sister live in Hidalgo County. He enlisted in 2001 as an infantryman and was on his third deployment, according to the news release. Montenegro served in Iraq in 2004 and Afghanistan in 2010. The world is a lesser place now that it lacks Monty's presence, said Chief Warrant Officer, 2nd Grade, Jason England. We have lost a true and faithful friend, and our nation lost one of its great warriors. Both soldiers were remembered in a ceremony on Friday at Bagram Air Force Airfield in Afghanistan. And I'll leave a little reminder that Thayer Ramirez has been buried recently in Arlington National Cemetery. To all the men and women out there that serve, to all those that have passed before us, we are going to dedicate a special song to them. It is by Todd Allen Herndon, and it's called My Name is America. You can download this song over on YouTube or on his website. Here is My Name is America.
Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name, I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the fire. Believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is who will
I've always got to mute my mic whenever I listen to that song because I end up starting to sing it in the background. That is My Name is America, obviously, by Todd Allen Herndon. And it's a dedication to all our troops. You know, Mike, it's really hard to play that song and not want to sing it, is it not?
Oh, it is, it is. I find myself singing it all the time, as of I did just now. And it's really funny is that we mention that every time we come back from that song. But it is, it's like, just lifts you up. That's My Name. We're going to have to play that once on November 8th when the revolution of the Tea Party takes over.
Yes, and we'll probably have to bring Todd back on for that one. We're going to bring on our guest. Her name is Diane Nagy. She travels with the Tea Party Express, and she's currently on tour on the Rebuild America tour, Barack Obama. And I'm not going to introduce her. I'm going to let someone else introduce her. This is from the Tea Party debate in July down in Tampa, Florida, and this is Wolf Blitzer. He is going to introduce our guest for me.
Hey, Wolf. Ladies and gentlemen, please rise now and join recording artist Diana Nagy as she leads us in the national anthem.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's reckless, the bombs bursting in air, gave that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land
And with that being said and done, I guess we should bring on Diane and her co-singer, Annie Ubelis.
Yeah, Diane, welcome aboard. I couldn't resist that.
Oh, that was great, Annie. Thank you so much. That's the first time I've heard it in that respect, in that style, and, you know, listening to it on my phone.
Yeah. I saw you at that debate, and Mike, my co-host, was sitting home watching it, and he said that the camera, because I was towards that back tier, and I was front row back tier, and my co-host claims that the camera panned in on me and caught me singing along with you.
Yay! Well, that's the name of the game.
It was you. It's not like I didn't. I was freaking out, so I'm screaming at him, that was her, that was her. But everybody's like, where? And I asked everyone, did you see Annie? And they're like, no. Of course, they don't know what she looked like, but that was great job, Diane and Aunt Annie in the background. Oh, go ahead.
My backup singer, Annie. I love that. Thanks, Annie.
Yeah. That was actually the debate that kind of kicked off. They had some minor ones similar, but that kind of really kicked off the battle of the GOP, because I think it was in that debate where basically, everybody stopped being so nice and started throwing the mud.
Yes. That was such an honor, because nobody had ever sung live the national anthem at a presidential candidate debate ever. I was the first one to ever do that. And they actually had me doing that pre-show the day before when we did a sound check. And they said, can you hold, please? And I said, am I in trouble? Producers were all talking, and I was kind of laughing. I go, uh-oh. And they said, you're going live. And they switched the whole program and brought me in live on the worldwide television to start the candidate debate the next evening. I was like, oh! That was fabulous.
How did that come about? I mean, that you were their choice, and how did that happen?
Well, I toured with the Tea Party Express, and the Tea Party and CNN sponsored the presidential candidate debate. So I always sing the national anthem, and somehow it came out that they had asked for me to sing the national anthem in the pre-show for that debate. CNN did. So because they had color guard and the Pledge of Allegiance and for the audience that were there live. And I was supposed to sing the national anthem at that time. But they heard the national anthem at the sound check the day before. They all had congregated a little meeting of which I didn't know what they were talking about. That's when I said, am I in trouble? And then they said, you're going live. So I went live the next day. So it was fabulous because it was CNN Tea Party sponsored. But I'll tell you, you know, the left got a hold of that because that was my audience, that video, that YouTube, because people put it, recorded it from their television, from their phone, like midway through. So, you know, not a great recording, and it was the left, and they just slammed it. And I'm thinking, really, people, it's the national anthem. Come on. They ripped me to shreds with terrible, mean, personal things, you know, saying things about me. Oh, my gosh, calling me a transvestite. And I mean, I can't even tell you the mean stuff that they said. And I thought, oh, my gosh, it's the national anthem. But apparently, I guess that was the audience that I had that night, so... that means you made it, huh?
Absolutely. Considering that was Wolf Blitzer, and I mean, sitting in the audience, I wanted to run up there on the stage and slap him a few times.
Right, you didn't. You know, politics is a dirty business, whatever side it is. It's, you know, in many, many ways, it's as low as some of these elections have gone to. I don't think there's any doubt that Barack Obama's election this year has taken politics to an all-time low. And he doesn't even have the nerve to do it himself. He has, of course, his cronies and his fake organizations do it for him.
Yep, exactly. Because he has the rhetoric all on the front, in the front lines, you know, has all the good things to say to get all the people wrapped up in what he has to say and thinks he's just so great. And it's crazy because nobody checks his record. Well, before they voted him in, they didn't check his record. And now they're not even looking at what's happening to the country. They still think everything's great because obviously the mainstream media is portraying it that way. You know, the economy's fine. And it's crazy if people really looked into his record and checked who he really is, that they still vote for him. And I think when they do that, they don't vote for him. And there's so many people, so many even Democrats that said, I voted for him in 08. I'm not voting for him again. So a lot of people are waking up, thank goodness.
Absolutely. I don't trust a single one of the polls. One of the things I'm going to be watching tomorrow's debate on is the fact-checking. No one fact-checks anything that Obama and his cronies are saying. They're just throwing things out in the middle of the air, and simply because they said it, it is therefore the promised one's word, so it must be the truth.
That's right. And they'll be all over Romney.
Absolutely. And it's going to be interesting to see how you have someone that's going to debate on facts and logic compared to someone that's just going to spout rhetoric. And we'll see which one comes out of the debate the better, one of the two. Now, you're right now on a tour. And our friend Lloyd Marcus is, I believe, the chair of the tour. He's going to be on Friday. And by the way, I want to make sure that you say hello to a couple of our friends out there, because I've been playing Ron and Kay's Reveille's song, Romney and Ryan, on the air here. And,
good.
And you have to give Andrea a hug from us, too.
I will. You know, I'm on the Rebuild America Defeat Obama tour, and I've been with Tea Party Express for all of their tours except just this recent one. They're starting, I think they're ending today, But I just couldn't do that tour and this tour. And this one is a longer tour, and it's going through November. So we needed to cover all our bases. I opted to do this tour and then not be with my TPX family on this particular one that they just did. But I'm really excited. We're on day four, I believe it is, three or four, I don't know. I don't want to start counting the days because this is the longest tour we've ever done, any of our tours. We're out for, you know, like 5.5 weeks. So up all the way through November. And what we're doing is at every stop, we're asking people to bring a picture of something that they built. And we are going to present that in a big collage to President Obama's campaign headquarters in Chicago on November 5th that in a statement that says, yes, we did build it. Oh, yes, Mr. President, we built this. Yes, so.
Yeah, you're
in a...
I think
we're
in Michigan coming to
right
my,
now.
To my, you're where?
We're in Michigan right now. I actually had to pull the bus over. Their bus was pulled over so that I could talk because we had really bad reception. And the bus driver said he opted. He said, you know, I'll go ahead and pull over. So we got gas and it all worked out good. So the whole bus is pulled over right now while I can, so I can talk to you guys for a few minutes.
What city are you in? I'm in Michigan.
You need to talk about us. You need to let people know. We were in Iron Mountain, and we're on our way to Ironwood.
Okay, uh-huh. You're way, way up in the UP.
We're
going all the way around.
Yeah, she's going to be by you in Grand Rapids on the 6th. I've got the whole schedule right in front of me. Today is Iron Mountain, and you're on your way to Ironwood, and then you go to Horton and Marquette tomorrow. And then if you're up in Michigan, you can pull up the schedule. Just go to campaigntodefeatobama.com. That's an easy site to remember. Campaigntodefeatobama.com. It has the complete list there.
Yep, or the rebuildamericatour.org will also take you there. Rebuildamericatour.org.
Yes. Well, let's tell everyone what you're doing, what you guys are doing. You're touring and doing what you're doing as you're touring.
We are... You know, we hit two cities a day. We have two shows a day. It's a patriotic, uplifting, love of our country event. I open with the national anthem. It's Lloyd and I who are the entertainers. Andrea Shea King, who is the vice chair, she speaks. Lena Owens, who is the co-vice chair, she speaks. Of course, Lloyd Marcus, who is the chairman, he speaks and sings. And then, you know, we do a couple of fun, like my song Back on Track. We do his beautiful new song. He does, and then we close, you know, God Bless the USA. We close it out with a military tribute with my song Where Freedom Flies. God Bless the USA and, you know, God Bless America. And it's just a really uplifting, feel good, motivate the people, get out. And, you know, we have some facts and we have some poignant statements and it's a show packed with a powerful punch. But it's mostly bringing 4th of July, hand clapping love of our country everywhere we go. It makes you proud to be American. It makes you want to go out and fight for America. And people have got to get the fire lit underneath them to go out and take this country back.
Yeah, and if anyone has never seen the Tea Party Express when they come through and do one of their tours, it is full of energy. Now, I've worked with you on three Tea Party Express rallies here in Beaufort, South Carolina. The first one, we did with you was November of, I believe, 2 years ago. It was around Thanksgiving. Matter of fact, it was 2 weeks after I had my knee replacement. And I think it was, the week before I had, what is it, Mike, was it 2 shows ago or 3 shows ago I played the clip from my 9/12 speech? That's
yeah,
where
that
I was.
That was 2 shows ago.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have up on YouTube a clip from that Tea Party Express tour through here when I did my little rant.
Yeah, awesome. Yes, that was great. I remember that. And the bus has got to leave, so I'm going to have to go. Maybe we can schedule another time. I'd love to come back and
all right,
visit with you. But we pulled over. Like, I was right on time, actually. So they'd already been waiting for me to come on board with you for 15 minutes. So now our time is up. I'm sorry.
Okay,
that's
Diane,
right. Well,
if you if the bus has any problems, you look up Casey Ford at ESPN 960 AM. He's up there. He's a friend of mine. He'll help you in any way he can if by any chance you have any problems.
Well, that's fabulous. Can he help us get the word out?
Oh, he's on ESPN 960. I think he can.
Okay. I will tell him.
So, Dan, I got to ask you a quick question, though, because according to the Honorable Maxine Waters, you know, your bus tour, a bunch of Hellraisers, you go in there and burn the town down, spread lies, and, you know, all the basically an Occupy Part 2. How do you respond to the queen of chocolate?
You know, and she's from my, I live in, right next door, she's from Berkeley. I live in Danville, which is the San Francisco Bay Area, Pelosi country. So I hail from that area, you know, so proud of them. Huh. Yeah, you know, we come into town, shoot, we love our country, we carry flags, we hug a lot of people, we clean, we leave the parks or wherever we are cleaner than when we got there. We sing patriotic songs, and we honor our military. Darn it. We are just hellraisers, aren't we?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Clean for our God.
Our founding fathers, our constitutional values, for what this country was founded upon, what they shed their blood for, what our troops have fought for. We are on the front lines now fighting that fight. You know, and they want to cut our military. No. We can't let this happen. And we need to fight the fight. We are on the front lines fighting this fight. And we're not going to give up. We are the heartbeat of America. We are the strength of America. We're in the battle of our life for the soul of America, and we're going to take it back, and that is our battle cry.
Oh, amen. God bless you, Diane. God bless you.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, travel safely.
Give Andrea a big hug and kiss for me.
I will. Can I say one more thing? Because I heard you talking about the religious freedom, and I'm Catholic. And so I want to tell all my Catholic friends out there that unfortunately and disappointingly, our Catholic vote voted in Obama. So the Catholics need to vote him out, and so we need to stand strong and be educated on the issues. We can no longer be silent Christians, because we're all Catholic now, because once he starts on the Catholics, he's going to start everywhere, and he's going to take religious freedom rights away from everyone. He's just starting with the Catholics, but we all need to fight this, and we all need to stand strong, and we can't stand silent anymore. So please, educate yourself on the issues. Know what is happening. We're here to articulate the values, educate on the issues, and we need to stand up strong and fight this fight and vote him out. The Catholics need to vote him out. I'm actually glad that the Catholic Church has woken up on this whole situation. I'm sorry that it had to be such an atrocity that we had to wake up to, but, you know, something needed to wake us up. So the Catholics, please, please, need to just stand strong with us. We need to stand together and fight for this country. And like you said, we're all standing this together. It's not just Catholics. It's everyone.
Right. How many are with your tour right now?
There's 11 of us.
11 of us. Okay. I'm going to make sure I greet you when you get off the bus when you come to my town.
Okay, great, because we're on two different buses. So there's 6 on one and 5 on the other. And we picked a few up here and there. So, you know, who knows? So it could be 13. Or we have a sound crew, too.
Oh, fantastic. All right. I want to remind everyone, go to campaigntodefeatobama.com or rebuildamericatour.com, and you can get the schedule. Also, check out Diane's website, diananeggie.com. You got a CD up there that you're selling. And when you go, I'm going to be playing your Back on Track as well as Freedom Flies.
Thank you. Where Freedom Flies has a great story behind it that we dedicated to my uncle, who was when the last plane shot down in World War II. But I can tell you about that next time.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. God bless you guys. It was an honor to be here. I look forward to seeing you again soon. Let's go out and fight this fight. This is our battle cry for the soul of America. Take it back.
Absolutely. We are going to take it back. And November 6th is going to be a dawn of a new day here in the United States.
Well, amen.
That's
on
right.
That.
That's right. And, you know, we've all given up our lives right now to be out here on the road for the 6 weeks. And it's a lot. But, you know, it's nothing compared to what would happen if we don't win this election. It's imperative. We got to keep the House, we got to take the Senate, and we got to take the White House. The Triple Crown, baby, Triple Crown.
Yep. I'm also going to tell some people running for county commissioner as well as state representative here in the Grand Rapids area. I'm going to email you information about a corrupt election taking place in this area. So when you guys get here, you'll be fully educated on what's going on. But we're going to have some candidates there greeting you as well.
That would be great. You know, email me that, because we'd like to hear from them.
Absolutely.
So let's coordinate
that. Better get on that bus. They're about to leave without you, honey.
I know. They're going to kill me. I got to go now.
Take care, Diane.
Bye, guys. Thank you.
Welcome
so
back
much.
Yeah, anytime.
We'll make sure we have the transsexual community there to greet Diane as well. You know, politics is just at an all-time low no matter what. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they're parading funerals of the passing soldiers, you know, calling their parents' names. And I mean, there's no thought, there's no heart. It's an emptiness inside. It's attack, attack, attack.
Well, I got to admit that I am very positive, and tours like this that Diana is on give me hope that we're going to turn this country around and bring back the hope and promise and the will to succeed that seems to have been lacking these last 4 years. And in that in mind, I'm going to be playing her song Back on Track. So sit back and enjoy her beautiful voice.
Get back on track. Big government out, get our country back. They spent our last dime, nothing left to borrow. Let's hand them all pink slips tomorrow. Come on, people, get back on track. Come on, people, take our country back. We the people, we've got to be heard. United we stand, spreading the word. The call to turn America to what our forefathers saw. Come on, people, get back on track. Come on, people, take our country back. We the people, we've got to be heard. United we stand, we're spreading the word. Are you ready? Let's go! One another,
hold your hand out strong. The sacrifice to help our brothers, we know what it takes. We gather the strength and find a way to be strong. The faith to carry.
Called Where Freedom Flies by Diana Nagy. You can get her CD by going to her website, which is Diana Nagy, NAGY.com. Does she have a voice or what?
You know what I'm thinking, but yes, absolutely. Oh my God. Ought to be a law against beautiful women like that, let me tell you. That's not only what these people are doing. Is on their own, they're getting on a bus. They're going around the country, basically in many, many ways, pushing for the Declaration and the constitutional values, to which Ben Franklin said to the lady, you have been given a republic if you can keep it. And these people are doing this on their own. Andrea's from Florida. Obviously, Diana's from the California area. Who knows where everyone else is from? But this is just such a wonderful, wonderful, in many, many ways, they're evangelizing, but instead of the religious topic, it is the Constitution. That's exactly what these people are doing.
Talk
about
the Republic.
Girls and role models, Annie. That's that's amazing.
Yeah. Now, if anyone looked at her biography, you know, at the age of 7, she won first place in a singing talent contest. At the age of 7. And she had the honor of singing before Pope John Paul II. And you have some damn fool over at CNN saying that she's a transvestite and can't sing? Think again, guys, here. Think again.
Oh, my God. I, for sake of, again, getting the wrath of Annie, everybody knows the way my mind is, but she is stunning. Just stunning. But, you know, as it always is, Annie, I mean, you've been subject to this, whether even with rhinos. There's just they cannot debate the facts of the Constitution, or it is a matter of fact the positives of the Tea Party. So you have Maxine Waters telling them to go straight to hell, or you have other people talking about they're racists, or Klan leaders are leading the rallies. Just anything negative, or to smear the name. Because they can't smear the message, and that is freedoms, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not pro-choice, some liberties, and the pursuit of government.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's Herman Cain has said it right, and I've said it on the show several times. When you debate a progressive, a liberal, a Democrat, whatever you want to call them, whatever the flavor of the day is, They all sin when they find out they're losing the debate to a logical conservative. The first thing they do when they find out they're losing the debate is the letter S. They switch the subject. You may be debating Obamacare, but they'll switch it over to, say, I don't know, the cost of refrigerators in China. That's not the subject we're debating, guys. Let's bring it back on course. When you do that to them and they find out they're still losing, they'll do the letter I. They'll ignore the facts. And I hear this every single time. I hear Biden open his mouth. I hear Obama open his mouth, or David Axelrod, or David Plouffe, or, I can't think of half the people that he's got shilling for him. But they throw numbers out and they throw things out and say things that simply because they said it, it has to be the truth. No, quantitative easing is not working. It never has and never will work. Sorry, Bernanke, it's not. And I know I'm going to say the name wrong. Economist, the last name begins with an M. I'm going to say Milton. Milton Friedman, thank you. I figured it out. Bernanke recently said Milton Friedman supports his quantitative easing. Oh, if Milton Friedman was alive, he'd probably walk up and bitch slap Bernanke. Sorry, it's not working. When they still find out they're losing the argument by ignoring the facts, the last thing they do before they walk away or run away or go and eat their rock that they crawled out from, they'll name call you. And you know what? Somewhere along the way, they're going to call you a Nazi or that you're Hitler-like or something, or you're a racist. They'll use name calling as if that's going to cause you to lose the argument. No. The second I hear you name calling me, I know. Not only have I won the argument, I just kicked your butt.
That is
that's a rant.
Well, you know how politics is, and that's very true. Well, this is always the discussion. This is always the topic. This is always the forum for politics going back to whenever the debate was began. Is that if an individual cannot beat you, they will smear you. And that's one of the reasons it still works. Politics is politics. And one of the reasons Herm Cain got smeared, and there is a huge war basically on the Tea Party itself, because what it stands for is what a large part of both parties don't stand for, and that is the Constitution, and that is the Republic. And both parties have individual agendas, and you know, sadly, this is what it comes to. It comes to a fact that a bunch of people would rather side with a political party, a cartel, or a country club organization rather than siding with the founding fathers who not only put this republic together, but many of the many of thousands and thousands of people that fought for the republic back in the war against England. What a shame. Oh, boy. Annie, where'd you go? Oh, my God. Annie is actually on the line checking with someone. Couple quick messages to follow up on for some of you.
Hello?
There we go. I got that straightened out so Annie could talk to her, what I think is our next guest. Anyway, Conservative Primetime is back, my friends. Tonight, Sarge and I and Jermaine will be back. We were back 3 days last week. Everything is going well. Today's topic is voter ID. We're going to talk about should you or should you not be forced to present an ID at the voting polls, proof that you can vote. And with that, will be tonight at 11:30, and I see Annie is back, so we'll toss it back to her. But Sarge and I and Jermaine tonight at 11:30, should you or should you not be required to have ID? Should you be able to walk in and say, my name is John Doe, and I'm voting? I sure like that rule. I'd be voting in every precinct. Anyway, go ahead, Annie.
Oh, that's a Democratic way of voting. Vote often. Not just once, but vote often.
I'm a Chicago man at heart.
All right, I want to bring on our next guest. He was supposed to be with us back in the beginning of September, but unfortunately he had gotten sick the same day I had to rush my husband to the emergency room. So we want to welcome aboard to our show Rich Miniter, who wrote the book Leading from Behind. Good afternoon, Rich. How are you doing today?
Great to be with you. I'd much rather see with you than seeing the inside of a hospital room any day.
Matter of fact, the show that you were supposed to be with when you were in the hospital with pneumonia, I actually ended up broadcasting next to my husband's hospital bed. I took the equipment with me.
Well,
talk about
that's
dedication.
The American frontier spirit, endlessly adaptable. And one of the things that's been lost in this whole war on women is that Obama and his supporters have totally forgotten the history of American women in America, which is to say frontier women, women who just made things happen, who are enterprising, who worked their way around it. And there's still millions of women like that today. And instead, they want all women to treat all women as helpless victims. It's just crazy.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I started a real huge dust-up on LinkedIn. I don't know if you're on LinkedIn, but I started question whether or not women should be in combat roles in the military. And I also linked it because I'm former law enforcement. And boy, us girls were kicking a lot of men's butts in that discussion. I think it's still going on. I started like a week ago, and as of last night, I was still getting postings on it. Holy moly. And some of the answers that I got were absolutely flooring me. So yeah, women can do it, and we do it. Listen, tell us what made you write this book, Leading from Behind.
Well, I was very curious about answering a big question. I couldn't believe no one else was asking this question. And this is the question. How does a guy who has almost no management experience at all handle the biggest management job in the world? If you look at Barack Obama, here's a guy, he had an illustrious career, but he was always at the law professor's lectern or at the committee table as a junior senator in Illinois or in the U.S. Senate. He was never in the front of the room directing. He was never managing. And we've all worked in jobs. We've had somebody with very little managerial experience who's suddenly put in charge. So on the other hand, I saw, that the Obama administration was accomplishing a lot in its first few years. Obamacare, but many other things, Wall Street reforms and so on. So I just wondered, how does he do it? So I told my editor, George Whitty at St. Martin's, I said, I'd like to write a book without adjectives. I think there's enough anti-Obama books out there. I'd like to talk to the people who work directly with the president on a day-to-day basis, inside the White House, in the federal agencies, in the halls of Congress, and find out exactly how he makes decisions. What is his leadership style? And what I found absolutely astonished me, that he doesn't like to make decisions at all. He's very dilatory. I mean, the conservative image of Barack Obama as someone who's relentlessly pushing America towards some socialist utopia in his mind is actually wrong. That's not what the people who, and most of my sources for this book, Leading from Behind, are Democrats, by the way, virtually all of them, both career and political appointees of the president. They see him as someone who can't make a decision, often can't make up his mind, is paralyzed by indecision often, and isn't quite sure what to do, and is afraid of risks. And it's not he's a much more timid and cautious leader than you'd expect. Now, he does have episodes of boldness. But I also realized that I learned through my reporting that his biggest successes are actually the result of strong-minded women who he takes credit for their actions. So when you look at the details of Obamacare, what I found to my surprise is that Barack Obama, he never campaigned on transforming the healthcare sector. It was not in his inaugural address. It just wasn't on his agenda. And when Nancy Pelosi, the then Speaker of the House of Representatives, brought it up to the White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, he was like, oh, no, that's a really bad idea. Look, we tried this in the Clinton administration. They called it Hillary Care. It was really unpopular. And it cost Democrats the control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 50 years, back in 1994. Let's not see this movie again. We know how it ends. But Pelosi was insistent, and she eventually won over Obama and then kept pushing him. There were key moments in the healthcare debate where Obama just wanted to give up. The opposition was just too tough. And it was Pelosi who had the steel spine, who kept driving it forward, coming up with innovative legislative maneuvers to keep it on track and to pass it. Now, I'm not a fan of Obamacare, But what I came away with is the idea that Nancy Pelosi is a strong-minded, ambitious, visionary leader, and Barack Obama really isn't. And I looked at other key decisions and leading from behind, such as the big budget fight of 2011 and how Barack Obama turned down an incredible offer from House Speaker John Boehner, the so-called Grand Compromise, where Boehner agreed to $800 billion in new revenue, mostly through closing tax loopholes and other technical changes. And in exchange, he wanted, you know, massive reforms of the entitlement state. Well, Barack Obama, you know, shook hands on the deal. They agreed on the technical terms. And then he backed away at the last minute. He just couldn't irk a bunch of old bull Democratic liberal lions in the United States Senate. We had a handful of old men, six or seven of them, who just didn't like the idea that they'd have to reform the entitlement state and change the legacy of their youth. Many of them had voted to put this in the 1960s and before. So, and I looked at the killing of bin Laden, and this is the one clear-cut example where it's supposed to be a great example of Obama's ability to lead. But when you talk to the people involved, a totally different picture emerges, where he cancels the mission three separate times. He stops or stalls the planning for the bin Laden raid. And even at the last minute, the day before the raid, he seeks a 24-hour delay. He says it's because of weather, but he just wanted to think about it again. So this is not someone who's very decisive. This is not someone with his own agenda. This is someone who's very cautious, who's been thrust into an executive role much earlier than in his career than he was expecting, and he's frankly just not ready for it.
Yeah, and it's funny because when you mention that thing with bin Laden, immediately what flashed through my head is this recent incident at the embassy in Libya. And as the facts are coming out, it seems that he's done that again, which cost the lives of four Americans and injuries to countless others, because every time they asked for more security, they're saying that it's heating up over here, we need better protection. They just decided to sit on their hands rather than move forward and protect our own American interests.
Well, that's right. And now it's emerging today that Al-Qaeda had attacked the consulate in Benghazi in eastern Libya twice before in this summer. So twice earlier in the year they'd attacked the embassy, the consulate in Benghazi, and the State Department knew about it, the president knew about it, and they didn't increase security. What's more, Al-Qaeda put threats out against the ambassador's life on Facebook. I mean, how can you possibly miss that one?
I don't know, but they seem to have done
it. I didn't know Al-Qaeda had a Facebook page, but Eli Lake in Newsweek today, who's an old friend of mine, is reporting this, and, you know, no reason to doubt that account. This is based on a letter they received from the Obama administration to Congressman Daryl Issa.
And talking about Daryl Issa brings it now fast and furious. It's another debacle, and they're trying to still blame it on Bush, and when they're two completely different programs. And just now, we're hearing now about another border agent being killed because of Fast and Furious. And I'm not even going to go into the Mexican government supporting its own people, suing our government because of the Fast and Furious guns.
Well, I was actually with the U.S. attorney, former U.S. attorney, who was hired by the Mexican government to investigate Fast and Furious. He was over at my house last night. The Mexicans are absolutely scandalized. Hundreds of Mexicans are dead. The death toll continues to grow as they find more and more forensic evidence linking American guns, part of the Fast and Furious operation, to Mexico. I have an entire chapter, by the way, in Leading from Behind about Fast and Furious, and I have the real reason why Eric Holder has not been removed by President Obama. But, you know, Fast and Furious is something that deserves a lot more media attention than it's getting. It's just not getting it. Now it also has emerged that there's a similar operation the Obama administration had launched in Florida aimed at moving guns from Florida gun shops into Colombia. So this scandal continues to widen. Eric Holder continues to stonewall. And the big question that no one's asking, isn't this a test of Obama's leadership? I mean, doesn't a good leader remove subordinates who have lied to Congress, as Holder and his staff have? Doesn't a good leader discipline his subordinates or at least call for an independent investigation? Instead, Obama has joined Eric Holder in the stonewall, and he extended executive privilege in order to shield more than 70,000 pages of documents from congressional investigators. If you're really interested in the truth, if you think the truth will set you free, why is he blocking congressional investigators from investigating what really happened at Fast and Furious?
I get a funny feeling that Eric Holder has a lot of dirt on Barack Obama, and if he were to cut Holder loose, really, the huge dam will break wide open.
In this case, from what our guest is saying, the truth will get you 20 years to life.
It will not get you.
Criminal cause in there, but I can tell you that Eric Holder has a real hold over Barack Obama. Partly because he has a very in-depth relationship with Valerie Jarrett, who is a principal advisor and mentor to President Obama and to the First Lady Michelle Obama. But also, don't forget, Eric Holder has a better relationship with the key constituencies in the black community than the president does. So Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson Jr., Jesse Jackson Sr., other key figures in the black community have had long-term relationships with Holder. He's a hero to them, and they have stood by him. At the same time, Barack Obama doesn't really have those relationships. And don't forget, Eric Holder is the first African-American attorney general in the history of the United States. So if Obama were to let him go, the consequences in the black community would be enormous. Now, that's not to say they're all going to go vote for Romney, but it could depress black turnout in this election. So if he were to let Holder go, maybe 5 to 7% of African-Americans would decide to stay home. That's enough to shift every swing state red.
Well, what they recently had where the ministers came out when he went with that healthcare thing about abortion and birth control and everything else, and they were talking about, you know, not voting for him or boycotting the election. Wouldn't that have been enough to scare him?
Certainly. I mean, that is a big part of the the complex relationship with the black community is that, I mean, this is not talked about publicly very much, but Obama isn't really fully accepted because he grew up in Hawaii, which is, you know, far from the usual African-American experience. He doesn't have relationships with, before he was president anyway, with the key leaders in the black community. He hasn't, other than Eric Holder, appointed a lot of African-Americans to key positions in the Obama administration, which is something that community has definitely complained about. And then there are certain things on their political agenda which he has not engaged on, let alone tried to pass. Then add to that, there are certain things that have frankly angered them, such as endorsing gay marriage or seeming to. That, you know, a lot of the members of the African-American community are very religious, Christian or Muslim or Nation of Islam, and they are theologically opposed to the changing the marital laws in that way. And so they saw that as a betrayal. They also don't like the idea of equating the struggle of in the gay community for their idea of rights with the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. They see these as different struggles, and they don't like the comparison. So there's a lot of risks here which the mainstream media has really not explored. But it's a complex dynamic, and that has enormous political consequences. And don't think that the White House hasn't looked at that pretty carefully.
Now, speaking of the White House, when I was reading your book, I found absolutely odd the dynamic that exists between Michelle Obama and Valerie Jarrett and how they use it to actually get him to bow to their wishes.
Well, it's certainly a key moment. Barack Obama is a smart enough man and a smart enough politician to know that you cannot succeed in American political life without the complete and unreserved support of your wife. And in 2003-2004, Michelle Obama was not convinced that Barack Obama should run for the U.S. Senate. She saw his job as a state senator as kind of a sideshow. She wanted him home more often. The routine in her family is that her father would come home from the water treatment plant and be seated at the dinner table every night at 6:30. And the family had dinner together. That was very important for her and her idea of stability and family values. And, you know, Barack was away a lot. He wasn't there. And that angered her. And throughout her, until he became president of the United States, Michelle Obama always made considerably more money than her husband. So she had the power of the purse, if you will. So she wasn't eager for him to become a U.S. senator because she saw it as a further distraction, higher cost. You have to fly back and forth from Chicago to D.C. It wasn't significantly more money. U.S. senators are paid about $165,000 a year. At the same time, Michelle Obama was seeing north of $350,000 when you look at both pay and bonuses and other valuable consideration. So she was opposed. And so she was counting on Valerie Jarrett to join her in that opposition. And initially, Valerie Jarrett did. Remember, Valerie Jarrett has been a mentor for both the president and Michelle Obama since 1991. Every important job Michelle Obama was to have since that time was at the behest of Valerie Jarrett, including the University of Chicago Medical Center job, her highest paying job, which she got when Valerie Jarrett was on the board. When Valerie Jarrett left the board and Michelle moved to the White House, that $300,000 a year job was abolished. So it was so important, they just eliminated it. Obviously, it was created just for her and closed just after she didn't need it anymore. So, and Valerie played a key role in every one of Barack Obama's political campaigns. So she's a mentor and a guide to both of them. So it's a key moment in late 2003. He wants to run for the U.S. Senate. He knows that if he can win Valerie over, Valerie can talk his wife into agreeing, and the three of them will form a united front that allows him to run for the U.S. Senate, which ultimately, to everyone's surprise, he wins. Partly he gets lucky. A sitting governor who's running for that seat gets into a little sex scandal. The other Democratic challengers get knocked off the ballot. I mean, it's a series of happy accidents from Barack Obama's point of view. Then a few years later, in 2006, 2007, he needs to have the same series of conversations again, both with Valerie and with Michelle, to persuade them that he should run for president. So he really is seeking essentially the permission or the cooperation of both of these influential women in his life.
Yeah, now, Valerie Jarrett is a very, very strange character. And I don't know why no one has actually ever gone after her. She was in charge of a housing thingamajig, I forget what you called it, and it ended up being a slum, and it was actually worse than when they took it over.
And the city of Chicago had to demolish it. Right? It was considered unfit for human habitation, and it was ultimately bulldozed by the city of Chicago. By the way, the cost of that was partly borne by the U.S. taxpayer, by taxpayers across the country. But yeah, I've got a lot of details about Valerie Jarrett in my book, Leaving From Behind. And it's, when you really dig into her career, by the way, she's born in Iran, in Tabriz, Iran, and two American parents, I should say. And their very first conversation, Barack and Valerie are talking about what it's like to grow up in a Muslim majority country. Now, she grew up in Iran and other places in the Middle East, and he grew up in Indonesia. And how that made them different, and how provincial and small-minded most ordinary Americans were, because they rarely traveled outside the country, let alone lived outside the country as children. So that was an early bonding moment for them.
Yeah, it's just weird the way everything that happens, she's got her thumb in it somewhere along the way. Matter of fact, what exactly is her position now in the White House? Because she went in there and just grabbed the office she wanted. It didn't matter what protocol was.
Well, right. I mean, she took Karl Rove's office, which is telling, isn't it? I mean, we know that Rove had an extremely influential position, more so than the White House chief of staff in the Bush years. And she took Rove's office. She's signaling that she is more important than chief of staff. And in fact, I think we've been through four, maybe five chiefs of staff now in the Obama White House in the first 4 years. Valerie hasn't moved. I mean, Valerie's position is rock solid.
And isn't she the primary reason Robert Gibbs is no longer there?
Absolutely. In fact, I tell that story in the book where she tricked and betrayed him and turned him into an enemy, unwittingly turned him into an enemy of the first ladies. And that story, too long to tell on the radio, but I think when you read it in the book, it's pretty shocking.
Yeah, I do have to apologize because of the debacle that happened with my husband in the hospital and so on and so forth. I had your book. I had it all with little post-it notes all over it. So I had all these things I wanted to ask you. And I went looking for it to put my notes together. And I think I left it down in Florida. I'm doing this all by memory. I don't know if I left it in the hospital or in the condo we were staying in, but like I said, I'm just doing this all from memory right now. Now,
it seems like with the Barack Obama administration, there's not just a story behind a story. It's like a story behind five stories.
There's a lot of complexity and a lot of, they have an agenda which they don't want to talk about publicly because, frankly, it's not that popular. If people really understood the agenda, they'd be opposed. For example, with Obamacare, people are in for a real surprise. I mean, the Obamacare taxes take effect for the first time this week. But already we're seeing changes in insurance plans and so on. And we're moving to a system where a lot of doctors are just going to opt out of taking Medicare, Medicaid, and government insurance in general. And they're moving to what are called concierge practices, where if you give them an extra $2,000 a year, the good news is you can see the doctor anytime you want within 24 hours. The bad news is if you're covered by a government-funded insurance, you have to go find a new doctor. So if you are an older person who's seen, has had the same physician for 10 or 15 years, he may not take your insurance anymore because he doesn't want to deal with the government regulation, the salary caps, the mandatory new tests, and so on. And so we're going to have two levels of medicine in the United States, just like, you know, like a South American country. And frankly, I've never considered Venezuela to be a model for anything, certainly not America's healthcare system. So I think as this system, as Obamacare is fully implemented over the next few years, I think people are in for a very rude awakening.
Yeah, and I can really attest to that because when my husband was in the hospital, he had just come out of surgery. I'm sitting there next to the bed while, you know, the anesthesia is wearing off. I get someone walking into the room that I thought was like, you know, social worker or a nurse's aide or something. She was from billing, believe it or not, from billing. He's not even there 24 hours. And she says, hey, listen, you know, you've got excellent insurance. You've got Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is through New York City Police Department where I retired. She goes, really good stuff, but I need $1,100 from you. And like, what? She goes, well, you've got this deductible and this copay and this and that. And she's rattling all this stuff off. And my mind is on my husband lying in the hospital bed, not on someone asking me to hand them $1,100 right there. Now, I'm telling you, this is what Obamacare has turned these hospitals into.
And they need to get the money because a lot of people simply aren't paying. In some hospitals, it's as many as one out of three patients don't pay at all. It's a real problem. And it's spreading not just from inner city hospitals, but across the country. What's more, Obamacare includes a lot of mandatory preventive care tests, which are a good idea, but they take up a lot of time. And so there are studies that show that the average doctor will have to spend 7.2 hours a day, 5 days a week, to do these preventative tests for the 40 million people who were just added to the healthcare system thanks to Obamacare. Well, how hard is it going to be to see the doctor if he's only got, you know, 0.8 of an hour left out of each day to see his other patients who have more serious issues? Because remember, under Obamacare, he's required by law to do these preventive care tests, these glorified physicals and blood tests and things like this. So, again, we're going to end up a two-tier healthcare system where people with a lot of money will have a very good healthcare, as good as they have today, maybe even better. But the rest of us will basically get health care by DMZ.
Exactly.
Now, the Democratic argument is, well, now everyone's covered. Well, what kind of benefit is that? The emergency rooms have always been required to treat you by law, whether or not you could pay or not. If you show up at the hospital and you're sick, they have to treat you by law, irrespective of ability to pay. And that's been the law of the land, by the way, for more than 40 years. So
well,
the benefit is pretty small.
I guess my question is, I don't really understand this with their argument, well, everybody's covered. How is everybody covered? I have to buy a policy. I currently don't have health insurance, and I really can't afford it. So now I'm just going to get fined or thrown in jail. I guess I don't get it, where the advantage is to individuals who simply can't afford it. They work.
Well, they want to decide that you get to spend less of your paycheck on food and housing and more on health care. That's what it amounts to. Now, it's a great boon to the insurance companies. They get all these new customers, which are required to buy their products by law. And it's a great boon to the unions who are able to shift the cost. Or a lot of unions have fabulous health plans, but it's a really high cost. A big percentage of dues goes to those. They can dump, the unions can dump people into Obamacare and then save that dues money for political campaigns or whatever they want to spend it on. So it's a great benefit to unions. It's a great benefit to big insurance companies. impossible for hospitals. It's going to lead to overcrowding. It's really tough on doctors. And for the rest of us, you know, it's not great at all. We're going to see waiting lists. We're going to see higher prices to see the doctor we kept before. I mean, it's, if people really focused on this, I, you know, of course, Romney is the wrong candidate to talk about this because he did something similar in Massachusetts. But people really focused on what Obamacare is. It's a nightmare.
Yeah, actually, I actually read both bills, the Senate and the House, before Pelosi even said something about you got to pass it. And I've written several different blogs about it and tearing it apart, showing why it was unconstitutional in so many levels. But I think the main reason why they got that through is it's part of Agenda 21. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but the more and more I'm seeing what our government is doing, even my local government, I'm aware that Agenda 21 is definitely full-fledged here in the United States. Because if you can't afford the health care and you have to spend now a majority of your paycheck on health care, you're not going to be able to afford that nice home out in the country. You're going to be forced into tenements in the city. That means then you're not going to be able to afford that nice, shiny new car, so you're going to have to use public transportation. It's another way of using Agenda 21 to herd us into areas they want to control us in. Honestly, that's what I think it's all about.
I don't know if it's about Agenda 21 or not, but I can tell you this. National health care has been part of the progressive agenda since the Woodrow Wilson era, you know, the so-called progressive era of the 19-teens, 1912, and so on. And it has been a part of the Democratic Party platform since 1948, since the Truman years. So this has been on their agenda for decades. And what Nancy Pelosi realized is that if they didn't do it in 2008, 2009, with big majorities of Democrats in both houses of Congress, a liberal president in the White House, they were never going to be able to do it. So even though the country was in crisis, unemployment was growing, gas prices were climbing, housing prices were sinking through the floor, even though people were worried, it looked like the financial markets were going to collapse, they focused on health care because this had simply been on their wish list for more than 50 years. And, you know, there's no secret about this. You can go back and look at old Democratic Party platforms. They're all on the Internet. They've been calling for this for decades and decades. Problem is, times have changed. You know, medicine isn't what it was in the 1940s. There's a lot more innovation. There's a lot more. We've learned a lot more about how everyone needs different kinds of health care. And a one-size-fits-all plan designed, you know, by a bunch of dreamers back in the 1940s is probably not the best way to go, given the new technology and our new understanding of the needs of people. And doctors have changed, too, and the way hospitals work has changed. It's all changed, except the political plan hasn't, and they managed to get it through in that first 2 years of the Obama administration, thanks mostly to Nancy Pelosi, who, you know, at some point, somebody on the left is going to write a very positive biography of her, because, frankly, even though, you know, I don't like what she did, I admire her leadership and her vision and her tenacity. I mean, she found a way to get this through, something which, you know, for more than a century had been on the Democratic Party wish list.
Yeah. Now, we're running down last 10 minutes here. So before we let you go, I want to talk about Israel and Iran and Obama. Yeah, why is it he's not a friend of Israel?
Well, I've always tapped her in Leading from Behind about this. But basically, Barack Obama's understanding of the Middle East comes through a handful of people. One is a man named Edward Said, who you probably have heard of. He was a Columbia University literature professor, but he was really the best-known Palestinian activist in North America for decades. He wrote a famous book called Orientalism, which argued that all Middle East scholarship was biased against Arabs and that they needed to have a new sort of pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian perspective. Well, Barack Obama wrote a number of letters, some of which I talk about in my book, to Edward Said, trying to get him to become a mentor. And eventually he did. They became friends. They had dinner together. They corresponded. They stayed in touch. And Said was someone he really looked up to. More importantly in his sort of development, in his intellectual development, though, was a guy named Rabbi Wolf, who was a neighbor of his in Hyde Park, Illinois. And Wolf is a very radical rabbi. He's opposed, to Israel as a Jewish state. He thought that Israel should admit Palestinians as full citizens and be a secular country. He also infamously wrote an article in 1979 calling on Jews to stop talking about the Holocaust. Now, let's think about that a minute. In 1979, the United States was in the middle of a tremendous national discussion about the Holocaust. There was that TV series, The Holocaust, this TV miniseries. There was the movie Shoah. And there was a great national conversation going on where people were really learning for the first time, because it's kind of got ignored in the first few decades after World War II, about what happened in the camps. And how even a seemingly civilized country like Germany could turn into a murderous place. And how, frankly, power is deadly. I mean, people talk about wars started by religion. They ignore the fact that virtually every genocide is led by a government. And certainly was the case in Nazi Germany. At that very moment, in which people are really beginning to draw big lessons and really think about the Holocaust, Rabbi Wolf writes this article saying that Jews need to stop talking about the Holocaust. And the reason why he wanted them to stop is he didn't want the sympathy to shift to the Israelis from the Palestinians. And he becomes a longtime friend of Barack Obama. Barack Obama often has dinner at his house. Barack Obama, Wolf died shortly after Obama's election. And Obama writes a very powerful note about his passing, which I think is subsequently published. And it's in Rabbi Wolf's house that Barack Obama meets a number of key activists who serve on the boards of J Street, which is an anti-Israel group, which serve on the board of Peace Now, which is another anti-Israel group. And so long before, and of course in Rabbi Wolf's living room, he meets a Palestinian activist named Rashid Khalidi, who is for the next generation of pro-Palestinian activists. Again, very influential. So he doesn't meet anyone who is pro-Israel until after he's a United States senator. And he makes his first trip to Israel. Now, he talks a lot about this on the 2008 campaign, how he's been to Israel. Well, the reality is he went to Israel for 48 hours. And that's 48 hours total travel time. You have to subtract the 9 hours flight each way, so you subtract 18 from that. He was in Israel for 30 hours, hardly enough to really get to know the country. And when he was in Israel, he talked to any ordinary people. He had a set agenda. Well, part of it is 4 hours away on a helicopter ride over the West Bank. But he doesn't talk to any ordinary Israelis or Palestinians. And as someone, I've been to Israel many times. When you talk to Palestinians, first of all, you get a much more nuanced picture than you'd get from the propaganda. Most of them are very happy Israel's there. The only thing they don't like about the wall is that it's hard to go into Israel to work, because a lot of them have jobs in Israel. And a lot of them also sell things to Israelis. If you're an Israeli living in Jerusalem, you will go into East Jerusalem or into Palestinian territories to buy a used car. That's typically where people do that. Sometimes for home appliances as well, if you were interested in used stuff. There's a lot of, and of course casinos. So there's a lot of back and forth between these people. Yes, there are ideological groups among the Palestinians who think that Israel ought to be eliminated, but most Palestinians just want to earn a living and send their kids to school and feed them and so on, and they don't have a fundamental problem with Israel. Most Israelis don't want to see the Palestinians suffer either. What they want is peace. They realize the Palestinians are being held captive by a large but not a majority group of extremists who kill dissenters. They don't tell you to shut up when they disagree with you on the West Bank. They come to your house and kill you. And so for Obama, he understands it simply in ideological terms. And all of his left-wing progressive friends, including David Axelrod and others, who were affiliated with these pro-Palestinian Jewish groups, have really given him a very narrow view of the crisis in the Middle East. If he had actually just walked around and talked to ordinary people, I think he'd have a deeper perspective. So that said, Barack Obama was opposed to Benjamin Netanyahu decades before I ever met him. He's expressing opinions opposed to Netanyahu before he's even met him. So it's not a personal chemistry issue, the way some people who defend the White House say. It's a steep ideological objection. Barack Obama literally believes that the Israelis are squatting on Palestinian land.
They don't even take effect that Israel was there long before the Palestinians. We're down to our last 4.5 minutes, Rich. I wish we had so much more time because there's so much to go into.
Well, I could talk to you for hours, of course.
Obviously, we definitely have to have you come back on, and I will find my copy somewhere along the way, unless you want to send me an autographed one.
Well, at premiercollectibles.com, we have where I should tell your listeners where you can buy autographs. I pre-autographed a number of them, but of course I can send you one personally. But if people are interested in getting an autographed copy, I think it's the same price as you in the ordinary bookstore, maybe it's a dollar more. They can check out premiercollectibles.com.
Yeah, and your book is on your own website, richardminiter.com.
Available on amazon.com or in any major bookstore. It's been on the New York Times, but I think it might still be on the New York Times bestseller list, but it was on the New York Times bestseller list in August and September.
Well, I can tell you that the library here in Beaufort does not have it in stock because someone's taking it out. Because I went yesterday to say, let me see if I can just get a quick copy and just run through the chapters so I can refresh my memory. And it's not there because someone has it out. So your book is out there. I really appreciate it, Rich. And I will get in touch with you so you can come back on. And it's been so much fun.
Oh, it'd be great. Yeah. Shoot me an email and I'll send you an autographed copy. And I'm happy to come back anytime. But you don't have to go to the library. Writers make their living selling books. You could go to the bookstore and support your local bookseller at the same time. One-third of independent bookstores have closed under Barack Obama, so they need your support.
Absolutely. And I fully agree in supporting our local businesses. So, Rich, this has been so much fun. I want to thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Take care and God bless. That's powerful?
We could have took that show till midnight.
Absolutely. It could go on for hours and hours. Listen, we're down to our last 2.5 minutes, so I want to thank everyone that's joined us in listening in and in the chat room. And we got a couple of good, exciting shows coming up. On this Friday, we're going to have two people, Xander Damos, who has New Age music, but he is a conservative young, and he wants to reach out to the youth through his music and give them the conservative message. But we also have Lloyd Marcus, who is a black conservative, who is in charge right now of this Rebuild America tour that Diane Nagy is on. And, oh, man, does he have some powerful songs, too, and a powerful story, how he went from pure poverty to what he is today. And then coming in next week, do you remember the name Anita Moncrief?
Certainly do.
All right. She's the one that blew wide open Acorn. She will be our guest on Tuesday. And then the following Friday, we're going to have a lieutenant colonel from the U.S. Air Force, Bill Connor. He's also ran for lieutenant governor here in the state of South Carolina, and he'll be talking to us about the Middle East. So we got a bunch of great guests coming up.
Wow. Southern Sense is reaching out to you, so reach back and touch us.
Okay.
Great job with those.
Yes, we had a fantastic show. I want to thank everyone that joined in the chat room. And I'm sorry, Allison was trying to call in, and before I can click on her to bring her on, she dropped the call. So I'm sorry, Allison, if you're going to listen to this in the archives, I apologize. And next time you call in, I promise I'll bring you on. So until Friday, remember, same time, same bat station, 2 o'clock. And I'll see you all here on Friday. So have a safe, healthy, and happy week, and enjoy the debates tonight, because I'll be there after my little barf bag laughing my ass off. Take care and good night. God bless.
Good afternoon, everybody.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to... You won't be-
Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.
American.